This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As a media columnist for the New York Times, my guest David Carr investigates the business of journalism and analyzes new developments in the media, including print, digital, film, radio, and TV. He's the breakout character in the documentary Page One, which follows the Times media desk during a tumultuous year that included layoffs at the paper, the Times publication of the WikiLeaks documents, and the introduction of the iPad. The film examines how new digital technology, blogging, and social media are changing how journalism is produced, distributed, and consumed. The documentary has just come out on DVD. David Carr is also the author of the 2008 memoir, The Night of the Gun, about his addiction to drugs and alcohol and his recovery. We recorded our interview Tuesday. David Carr, welcome to Fresh Air. So last night I was checking your tweets, and you said that you know your cold is a common cold if you go to the pharmacy and they're out of all your favorite remedies. And I thought, oh no, my guest for tomorrow has a cold. Maybe he'll be too sick for the interview. Maybe he'll have laryngitis. You really had me worried.
Isn't it important that you knew that I was having trouble finding my medicine at the drugstore? I mean, well, yeah, I thought it was important to share that with the world.
Well, I was wondering, what made that tweet worthy? Why did you decide to tweet that?
Because sometimes you want to grab what is in the air, so to speak, and just put it out there. One time after the Winter Olympics ended, I am a Winter Olympics freak. I just love them. And I think 2 days after it ended, I just said, I missed the Olympics. Well, that got retweeted almost more than anything I've ever written about. And it's just something that's in the air. And so I don't like to do health tweets or food tweets because you're going to end up sort of in a very banal territory very soon. But I thought it was remarkable that sort of wall to wall at a drugstore in New York, all the cold remedies were gone. And so that other people would sort of nod their head when they read that.
How have Twitter and other social network sites changed your reporting? Like, how do you use them as a reporter?
I think the fundamental thing that has changed is I would be someone that would, after I woke up, would check an RSS feed, meaning a feed of all the sites that I'm interested in, and I would browse that feed and see what was of interest to me. I think of Twitter, I follow about 600 people, many of whom are in my business or share my interest, as kind of a human-enabled RSS, and what they're reading and thinking about at any given moment is of interest to me, and it serves to sort of edit what's going on in the world, and it puts a human sort of curation on this huge fire hose of data that's washing over us all the time. You know, the question becomes where to look, and it's nice to have some other people pointing the way.
Did you resist social networking at first?
I really thought Twitter sounded like the dumbest thing in the world. There's the name to begin with, the whole nomenclature of Twitter, tweet sort of impugns itself. I'm a person who has trouble codifying their thoughts in 800 words, which is sort of a standard length at the New York Times. And the idea that I could communicate anything of value in 140 characters, I thought sounded preposterous.
But
I began to understand that as a reporter, it was an important listening tool. And that's how I first used it, less as a megaphone and more about listening. And then I realized back when I was the editor of a newspaper, I was a decent headline writer, and that links would carry far more complex information, and that annotating those links and putting a little spin on them and sending them out into the world would have significant value to the people who follow me. I think it's Jeff Jarvis who talks about sort of mind casting, meaning what I'm reading, what I'm thinking about, what I'm seeing, versus life casting, which is where I'm going, who I'm seeing. And for instance, I was in Norway last week. I don't like people who travel tweet, who talk about where they are. I'm here in this fabulous place and you're not. So I didn't tweet about Norway a lot.
So just another thing about how your journalism is changing because it's on different platforms. When one of your articles is in the New York Times online, if there's any mistakes that were made in the article, those mistakes are corrected at the bottom of the article. It used to be that corrections were kind of buried in like page two or something. Nobody ever saw them. So your mistakes, your errors weren't like following you around, but they are now. What's that experience like of having the mistakes corrected at the bottom of the article?
You know, I have to tell you, when I got to the New York Times, which was about 10 years ago, I was paralyzed by the idea that my reporting lacked the professionalism and efficacy required to be in the New York Times. I had done a lot of writing and done a lot of reporting, but I now was at a place where kind of the size of the megaphone and its sort of history made it all the more powerful, and that if I said something that was unfair or untrue, that I could snap somebody's career in half like a dry winter twig. And sure enough, after I started, I quickly ended up on page two in the corrections. And you used the term buried. They're not buried to us. That is a hall of shame there, and it's a page you want to totally stay off of, and it's material to your sort of career there. So it's very, very important. And it doesn't matter where error occurs. It always follows you around. And part of the deal with working at the New York Times is that your readers, a portion of whom are kind of church ladies and copy ninnies and fact freaks, they wait like crows on a wire for you to make the slightest error and then descend caw, caw, cawing every time you screw up. And it still is something that wakes me up at night after I've written something. I wonder if I got something right. And so the fact that now they follow me around like tin cans on the internet, at least on the web, you can amend. You know, the ethic of the web is to say what you know as quickly as you can and then reiterate over and over again. The web is kind of a self-cleaning oven, and what you have up there could grow more efficacious, more accurate as time goes by. That's never true of print. It's always there for the ages to haunt you if you got it wrong.
If you're just joining us, my guest is David Carr. He writes a Monday column on the business of media for the New York Times. And he's also one of the people followed, really the main person followed, in the documentary Page One about the media desk of the New York Times. And that documentary is now out on DVD. At the beginning of the film, at the beginning of the documentary Page One, you're on the phone with a source, and you're saying to your source, "I see this as a big story. I could probably get significant space. What do you think the story is that I should tell?" I thought that was such a really interesting way of putting it. Do you say that a lot to sources? What's the story you think I should tell?
It's a funny thing because it's that's experience that came off. I wrote a book a couple of years ago, and I did significant press at the time, and there were two kinds of interviewers. There were ones that would make sort of speeches about what I had done and have a grand theory about what my book was about, and many of them quite marvelous and well thought through. And then there were people who asked simple, direct questions. And almost to a person, the best stories came from the people who asked simple, direct questions, and you'd say, well, that's only logical. Except historically, I had been a reporter who was very fond of making speeches and very fond of telling people what their stories were about. And so that was very sort of hard-won information on my part that I had to ask and then stop talking. And asking people what they think the story is, you know, we are people who just show up and declare ourselves as instant experts on all manner of stories. And we often are only taking a very sort of blunt force guess about what's going on. And I think it always behooves us just to ask the people, especially if you're aspiring to do something good, what do you think's going on? What do you think this is about?
And do you use that question especially when you know there's going to be conflicting points of view on a story and you're talking to representatives of those different points of view?
Well, I strive for congruence. And by that, I mean there's an interview near the end of the movie with officials at the Tribune Company. It's far less friendly. It's far more declarative. And I'm telling the person at the other end of the phone what I think the story is about. I don't want to be sort of a poodle dog when I'm out there and a friendly sort of presence in people's lives and then come back and do something that's really mean or aggressive. And if it's going to be a hard story, one of the things I always say is, this is going to be a really serious story and I'm asking very serious questions and it behooves you to think it through and really work on answering and defending yourself because this is not a friendly story. And if they don't engage, I just tell them, well, you know what? You better put the nut cup on because this is not going to be pleasant for anyone. I worked at a weekly with a lot of young reporters and I would hear them pouring on the honey on the phone and being real sweet and nice with the people that they talked to. And then they would and then they would turn in these stories that were scabrous and really mean. And I said, well, you're setting this up so the phone call is going to come to me, not you. And you haven't done these people the privilege of giving them an opportunity to defend themselves. I don't think people who read your work, who were involved as sources, should be surprised. I often read significant parts of the story to the people that are involved because I don't want to sit up in the middle of the night and wonder whether I was fundamentally unfair to the person that I didn't communicate to them what is coming and that they'll be genuinely surprised. I don't want anybody to open up one of my stories and have their nose broken by what they read. Although, you know, I do got to say at the beginning of the week, I wrote a really mean column and I didn't tell anybody involved. So I guess that's not always true.
At the beginning of this week?
Yeah, I wrote about bonuses.
Yeah, you had a story that was headlined, "Why Not Occupy Newsrooms?" And you're basically asking how come there isn't an Occupy movement in newspapers because newspaper executives are guilty of some of the same things that bank executives are. Make the analogy for us.
Well, in the instance of Gannett, Gannett is a publicly held company that owns 82 newspapers across America in towns big and small, dailies and weeklies. And in the past 6 years, they've gone from 52,000 employees to 32,000 employees. Their stock price, which is the general metric of publicly held companies' health, went from $70 a share to about, or $75 a share to about $10 a share. The guy who oversaw it, the CEO, Craig Dubow, when he left, received $37 million in health compensation and disability benefits. And it seemed, I mean, to me, the Occupy movement is a lot of people tag it as socialist or communist. I just think it's people who are angry about capitalism not working. If you make bad choices, you pay the price. In this instance, and at the Tribune Company, which I also wrote about, the chief executives made choices that resulted in a lot of people getting rolled out of the back of the truck. Now, it was a very challenging environment for newspapers, but I don't think that people should benefit in the tens of millions of dollars for just firing people. There's no innovation there. There's no magic to that. And I don't think that kind of sort of thinking and strategy should be rewarded. So I don't know. I just wrote what was basically a screed. And oddly enough, it was weird for me. I was writing about newspapers and it totally connected on Twitter. And I thought, well, Twitter does not care about newspapers, and yet this thing is rolling over and over again, being retweeted thousands of times. I got probably 300 emails. What is it about this? And what it is, it's about the trashing of once great American institutions, and that's a story that the general public never tires of.
Now, when you started talking about this, you described the article as, was mean the word you used?
It was mean.
So what was different in terms of how you handled this article and how you typically handle articles that are investigative or critical of the organization that you're writing about or the company you're writing about?
Well, I had done a story a few months ago about Gannett's bonuses, and I spent 4 days trying to get the company to comment on what they did, and on Sunday night, just before deadline, they said, we're not going to have any comment on these bonuses. And I just said, really? Your newspaper company, your publicly held company, these bonuses are a matter of public record, and you have nothing to say about them. And I just found that appalling, and I think some of that was sort of reflected in the fact that, A, I didn't bother to call them, and B, that I was angry after I'd written about their last set of bonuses, that they clearly were living a life beyond consequence, and they just stepped up and did it again and gave this guy a huge bag of money on the way out the door.
Do you feel like, as a reporter who covers the business of media, that you are reporting on the dismemberment of your own profession?
No, I think I'm living through a golden age of journalism, actually. I do think that there's been horrible frictional costs. But I think when we look back sort of at what has happened, I look at my backpack that is sitting here, and it contains more sort of journalistic firepower than the entire newsroom that I walked into 30, 40 years ago. It's connected to the cloud. I can make digital recordings of everything that I do. I can check in real time if someone's telling me the truth. I have a still camera that takes video that I can upload quickly and seamlessly. And I think that the ability to sit at your desk and check everything against history and build in context and narrative, it's part of how, you know, newspapers ended up becoming sort of daily magazines, is all the analytics are baked in because the reporters are able to, you know, check stuff as they go, and he or she can just jam it right in there. Now, the business model has not kept up with that, and the movie, Page One, does a really good job of capturing an incredibly scary time about whether fundamental questions of survival were being asked about the New York Times and other organizations. And did I worry that somewhere in there when I was doing a big job cut story that eventually I would type my own name? Yes, I did. It was really scary for a while. It's less scary now.
What's your typical media diet in the course of a day or a week?
I find myself watching a great deal of television. I think that a lot of the great sort of narrative work has gone to television. And I think the ability of people like me to just program their diet as they see fit. I just think there's a lot of good things going on television. When I wake up in the morning, the gun goes off. I'm checking Twitter. I'm checking RSS feeds. And I get 4 newspapers at my house every day. I get The Wall Street Journal, the New York Post, the Star Ledger, because I live in New Jersey, and of course the New York Times. And the reason I do is because the day before this, all this stuff has gone whizzing past me, and I seem to know a lot, but I don't really know what part of it is important. And I used to think it was so silly that newspapers would, like, I'd go to our Page One meeting, and they'd be organizing this hierarchy of the 6 or 7 most important stories in Western civilization. Meanwhile, the web is above them, pivoting and eliding, and all these stories are morphing and changing. I thought, well, how silly is this? But you know what? I came to want that resting place where someone yelled stop and decided, look, this is stuff you need to know about going forward. So there's both real-time news, and then newspapers have become a kind of magazine experience for me, where they're where it's a way to look back at what has happened.
Do you ever feel like your brain isn't really equipped to sort through and synthesize all the information that you're inputting into your brain?
I'm sorry, what was the question? I'm kidding, Terry. Yes, I worry about it constantly because, number one, in writing terms, if I become good on Twitter, will I lose my ability to think long thoughts? Number two, my nightstand is groaning with Netflix, with an iPad, with books that, you know, my friends have written about things I'm interested in and I haven't gotten to them. So it sort of implicates me sitting there. And meanwhile, you know, I walk through Times Square and I see messages on a zipper. I go to buy groceries. There's more messages. I ride the elevator up here. There's more messages. And I think that it does sort of paralyze you. My more sort of persistent concern is that I will become so busy producing media that I won't consume enough of it, so that what I produce becomes less and less rich over time. What it reminds me of is being at a convention, whether it's a political convention or South by Southwest, or covering a big story like 9/11 or Katrina, all of those things I've done. When you're in the middle of things and pushing out a lot of information, you really have no idea what's going on because you have no time to watch or listen or consume. That's my problem at 55 years old. I don't notice it among my younger colleagues. They don't. Brian Stelter, who's also in the film, the act of producing media and consuming media, those are not discrete things to him. He does both at the same time in a way I don't. I can remember when bin Laden was killed by U.S. forces, about the time I was going, maybe we should do a blog post about this, I opened up the media blog that I work on, and Brian Stelter, my colleague, already had 700 words up there. And so I'm like, you know, it's like I'm working through Jell-O and he's not. He's in a different sort of universe. But I'm familiar with all the platforms, have engaged in them. I mean, I set up a fully equipped studio in my basement and wrote and edited video and sent it out to the world every day. They ended up looking like hostage videos. They were horrible. You could almost smell the dead bodies. But it's still, I got the experience. And I learned to do it. And I've never understood some of my colleagues saying, oh, that crap's for someone else. It's like, that maybe would have worked 5 years ago, but that isn't going to work anymore.
You moderated a panel at South by Southwest that was titled, I'm So Productive, I Never Get Anything Done. And it was about how answering email and looking after accounts on Facebook and Twitter and Tumblr left no time to do what one actually cares about or gets paid for. And it seems unavoidable nowadays if you're really as immersed in media as you're describing.
I'm really thinking about this in the coming year, partly because I did a lot of work with the movie and I did a lot of speaking at colleges and I did a ton of communicating interviews with kids working on papers and email correspondence or Twitter correspondence with people who are curious about things. I want to be two-way. I want to be available. But I'm in danger of being one of these guys who talks about their jobs instead of doing it. This is the first year when I think my productivity has really sort of dropped because of it. And I'm looking at the coming year and thinking, what am I going to give up? Am I going to give up following the NFL? Am I going to give up listening to music and going out and seeing it? Am I going to give up riding my bike? Or am I going to cut back on some of these digital habits that I have that are eating me alive and some of these sort of speaking, panelizing the endless panels about the future of journalism? The future of journalism is wearing badges and talking on panels, as far as I can tell.
A few years ago, you wrote a very personal memoir about being addicted and recovering from the addictions. And the addictions were coke and crack, and you had alcohol problems, too. The book is called Night of the Gun. And, you know, I'm just wondering, like, did the New York Times, when you got your job After you were clean, after you were sober, and you got your job with the New York Times, how much did they know about the addiction part of your past? I mean, it's not the kind of thing you put on your resume, but did you talk to them about it?
I think I actually did.
Did you really?
In terms of, like, my communication to them. I mean, part of... I didn't want there to be any surprises about sort of who I am and what I've done. What I tried to emphasize is, you know, I was a very low bottom, poly addicted, crackhead drunk, whatever you want to call it, number of misdemeanor arrests, violence against all sorts of people. And what I wanted to point out is that since then, you know, I'd been a single parent, I had gotten off of welfare, that I had taken any number of assignments and done a good job, that I had run newspapers, that I had done a few things since then. But still, when I did the book, you know, I went to my boss, Sam Sifton, at the time, and he said, I'll walk the book down there, but I think you probably should do it. And I said, well, do you have a pair of tongs or oven mitts or something that I can use to hand it over? Because it was a very, it's kind of a dark book. And when I gave it to him, Bill Keller said, you know what, we don't hire nuns, we have no problem with your book. You know, they said they were proud of the book. But
getting back to them hiring you, you know, before the book existed, they were okay with it? Like, you told them your story and they had faith that you would remain sober and do a good job?
Yeah, it's not something that we committed to directly. I mean, I didn't, in fact, remain sober. So, and I don't think that that's part of the contract. I did try drinking again. It didn't go very well. My work never suffered per se. My work rarely did. It's always the last thing to go. But if you took all of the functioning alcoholics and addicts out of the American economy, you'd be taking out a lot of firepower and a lot of talent. In the main, while I've been at the New York Times, I've been completely sober, highly productive, true to my word, doing my best like everyone else there to get it right. But they don't, I've seen people at the Times tumble and get in personal trouble. And you know what? That place, it's weird, but it will pick you up and accommodate all manner of human frailties. Because people are pushed to the limit at the place. And when somebody stumbles, it's an incredibly humane place. And I know that sounds gooey and horrible. And I never really needed it or required it. But I've seen, it's like when you're on deadline there and you really can't quite get it done and there's not enough room. And somehow everyone around you will sort of lift you up and throw you across the goal line, and then you're the one who stands up the next day and puts your arms above your head because you made a touchdown. Everybody there is working very hard to make it better.
So this question is probably way too personal. So just...
I bet not.
Well, just tell me if it is, because I don't want to be intrusive. For a lot of people who are giving up an addiction, they're encouraged to, like, find a higher power that they can, you know, turn to and believe in, whether it's religion or something else that will function in that way. Was there such a thing for you?
You know, it's funny you should mention that, because I'm in the middle of sort of a struggle with that. And it's not that I am a church-going Catholic, and I do that as a matter of, it's good to stand with my family. It's good that I didn't have to come up with my own creation myth for my children. It's a wonderful group of people that I go to church with, and it's community. It's not really where I find God. And sort of what the accommodation I've reached is a very jerry-rigged one, which is all along the way in recovery, I've been helped, without getting into the names of specific groups, by all of these strangers, you know, who get in a room and do a form of group talk therapy and live by certain rules in their life. And one of the rules is that you help everyone who needs help. And I think to myself, Well, that seems remarkable. And not only is that not a general human impulse, but it's not an impulse of mine. And yet I found myself doing that over and over again. So am I, underneath all things, just a really wonderful giving person, or is there a force greater than myself that is leading me to act in ways that are altruistic and not self-interested and lead to the greater good? And so that's sort of as far as I've gotten with the higher power thing. Is I'm, you know, I'm kind of a pirate, kind of a thug. I mean, I've done a bunch of terrible things, and yet I'm able to, for the most part, be a decent person. How is that? Do I have some inner strength of character? I think not. I think something else is working on me.
So in the spirit of reflection about whether you will have a higher power in your life and what that higher power will be, how are you thinking about it? Like, are you reading things you hadn't read before? I mean, how do you figure that out?
One of the things that I'm doing is praying, which seems like a really uncomfortable, unnatural activity for me. It's to whom, to what, about what. You know, I have a prayer in my wallet that I'm saying, and I feel like a complete fraud while I'm doing it. But it's the act of acknowledging that there may be something else out there. And so it isn't, I haven't really thought it through, but I think the behavior and the activity will sort of lead to something good. Anything that sort of gets me into a place of something less than self-obsession and gets me into a place of some humility, not even acknowledging a higher power, but that other people exist and they're not here as an extension of my world. I think that part of the reason I got involved in journalism is I love the stories of other people. I mean, everybody's got a story to tell. When all these layoff stories were coming, I was just thinking to myself, good Lord, what if I would have to go and get a real job? How horrible would that be? Because I view what I do as something of a caper, not really work.
Can I ask what the prayer that you're keeping in your pocket is?
Sure. Let me look at it. It's really full of like these and thous and I think it's the prayer of St. Francis. What it would be known programmatically, again, no names mentioned, is kind of a third-step prayer. I'm not comfortable reading the whole thing, but what it talks about is to offer yourself to God, to build with you as God would see fit. And then the important part to me is to relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. And then it goes on to say, take away my difficulties. Of course, everyone prays for that. We all do. And that victory over them will bear witness to a power greater than yourselves. And just says, may I do the will always. I don't really know who I'm talking about when I say those words, but I sort of feel good when I do.
I can understand that.
Yeah, I don't, like, I think it's okay to sort of like have a superstitious belief in God and not really have thought it through. I think it's okay to just, I think there's freedom in allowing for the possibility of it. Like, I don't have a presence. I don't have some idea in my mind of a woman or a man figure or anything like that. But I find the spaces between people, whether I'm making a newspaper with them or in recovery or living with them as family or friends, or I find something really godly in that. I don't have trouble acknowledging that.
So there you found something godly, but there isn't a theology that you're following.
Yeah, I've been watching sort of this debate over Mormonism that's gone up because of the folks that are running for president, people making fun of their theology, and then I think, well, I'm a practicing Catholic. We suggest that in churches all over the world that there's a metamorphosis of bread and wine into the body and blood of Jesus Christ, which we proceed to eat and drink, which when you really take a step back is sort of creepy, right? But that's who I'm running with. So I, you know, whether it's the kind of underwear people wear or the hats they wear on their head or the turbans or whatever, again, I make no judgment. So, I find comfort in those traditions.
So your voice has a kind of hoarseness to it.
Right.
A little raspy. Was it always that way, or is that related to the drugs that you did back then, or to the cancer that you had after that?
You know, it's a little tough to pin down because I've smoked on and on all my life tobacco. So a lot of people who smoke tobacco sound like me. When you smoke cocaine, you're taking in vapors that are coming into your lungs at a really high temperature. And so could that have made a problem? I took, I had Hodgkin's lymphoma, and I took a lot of radiation to the mouth and throat. So could it have been that? I mean, I have, I walk around, and you can see in the movie, page one, I walk around with my neck bent. That's from the muscles sort of getting shot out by all the radiation. I will tell you something interesting, though. I spent a couple weeks working 9/11, you know, working the pile. My job was to cover a fireman. I never had a hoarse voice before that.
Really?
Yeah. So I think that's when it declared itself. And it sort of comes and goes based on the amount of fatigue I have. I could have surgery to remove the vocal notes, but I've had a lot of surgeries. I've had a very medicalized life. I have no spleen. I have one kidney. I have no gallbladder. I have half a pancreas. And the idea of sort of willingly allowing people to cut into me, I'm probably not for that. I'll just deal with the hoarseness of the voice.
Well, David Carr, it's really been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
It was a pleasure to speak with you, Terry.
David Carr's media column is published in the New York Times Mondays in the business section. He's featured in the documentary Page One that follows the Times media desk over the course of a year. It's just come out on DVD. Carr has an essay in the companion book Page One. You'll find a link to David Carr's New York Times page and information about how to follow him on Twitter on our website, freshair.npr.org. Deer Tick has just released its fourth album called Divine Providence. It's the second album this year from lead singer John McCauley, who put out Middle Brother, a collaboration with other musicians that rock critic Ken Tucker reviewed this past March. Ken says the new Deer Tick album takes this Providence, Rhode Island band into a more raw-sounding direction.
For life and a dangerous mind, my trail of dust, who knows what you'll find. I can take a tree and tear it from its roots.
The title of Deer Tick's new album, Divine Providence, is a pun. The band hails from the capital of Rhode Island. But the other side of the pun is sarcastic. There's little concerning divine providence or care. Neither is the band provident, frugal, or prudent about its talent and music. Group frontman John McCauley continues to sing as though the primary idea is to shred his vocal cords. And on this album, the goal is to convey something of the band's live performances, a headlong mixture of loud guitars and cover songs, plus originals that remind you of songs they might cover.
I don't care if it rains,
let's all go to the bar.
I don't care if there's a hurricane,
let's all go to the bar.
I don't care if I'm the one to blame,
let's all go to the bar.
Gimme, 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 I always want
That's Deer Tick channeling their inner Ramones on You Got It, Let's All Go to the Bar. The music on Divine Providence is pickled in alcohol. Songs that don't contain references to drinking sound as though they were recorded under its influence, if not both combined. But it's not alcoholic music, that is, made without control or an awareness of what's at stake in committing to this pose. The booze fuels both frantic moments and more contemplative ones. This is the first Deer Tick album on which other members of the band besides McCauley regularly come front and center to sing. Bass player Chris Ryan does a fine job on Clownin' Around, a song about a guy who knows his jaunty exterior isn't fooling anyone close to him about the melancholy he's feeling, the devils he's haunted by.
Though I've walked down a crooked path, that don't mean it wasn't cursed. My feeble heart was filled with wrath, my poisoned mind with thoughts perverse. And the devil is living in my basement. I'm trying hard to hide him from my wife, and I know someday I'm gonna have to face him. But for now I keep my secrets with the knife.
The prettiness of Clownin' Around is an exception on this album, however. Most of the time, Deer Tick is happy to summon up the influences of the Rolling Stones, the Kinks, and the Replacements. A bonus track buried a full half hour after the disc supposedly ends is Mr. Cigarette, written for the band by the Replacements' Paul Westerberg. Then there's their Phil Spector meets Rod Stewart mashup, a fine mid-tempo rocker called Main Street.
I can't sleep, I can't close my eyes. Blip for 1 second and the whole world pass you by. Yeah, I guess I'm in all the days I spent. I can't eat, I can't use my mouth. Miss one.
Still in his 20s, McCauley has been influenced by some good stuff. In concert, he's been known to have Deer Tick cover music by Hank Williams, John Prine, and Michael Hurley. The group has occasionally done entire sets devoted to renditions of Nirvana songs, advertising these performances under the band name Deervana. You can listen to this album, Divine Providence, and dismiss it as a juvenile party record. After all, the song that began this review, The Bump, features the shouted chorus, "We're full-grown men, but we act like kids." True enough, as far as it goes. But as Deer Tick has proved in the past, and probably will elaborate further in the future, this is also a band attuned to using its music to work through various kinds of pain. The pains you can't just numb with a lot of whiskey and some slashing guitar chords.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Deer Tick's new album, Divine Providence. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org, and you can join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, John Myers, John Sheehan, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. I'm Terry Gross.